B-Pod Studios.
Ready, set, go!
This is Checkpoint XP Daily, your daily dose of esports and video game discussion. A complete look at all things esports and gaming. A production of Beasley Esports XP. Here are your hosts, Nate Bender, Robbie Landis, Norris Howard, and Joe Sloan.
Checkpoint reached.
Hey, welcome to Checkpoint XP Daily for Thursday, July 11th, 2019. Esports and gaming, and day four of the Beasley XP Studio Grand Opening today, brought to you by Brave Dog Games. Welcome into the show. Glad to have you here. Coming up today on Checkpoint XP Daily, we'll hear from FGC caster Script, and we'll also sit down with good friend of the show, Noah Smith, to talk about what esports contracts should look like. Those conversations are ahead here today on Checkpoint XP Daily. But we start today talking about the ESPYs.
That's right.
Oh, boy.
That is right.
So, Norris, you, I feel like you had some thoughts.
Yeah,
like,
so
like you might have thought some things about this.
Here's the thing.
Maybe felt a few feels.
The ESPYs revealed or announced earlier this year that they would be having the first esports award at the ESPYs.
First category.
Dubbed the best esports moment.
Which when we heard about this, we kind of hailed as like, oh, that's fantastic.
This is great.
This is great that the ESPYs are getting in on esports. They're more meaningfully embracing esports.
It may
and
have not panned out that way.
Now, last night
all,
happened.
First of all, let me just put this out here. The winner of this year's best esports moment was O'Leary from the Cavs
NBA 2K league
team, which completely deserve it. Individual.
His return, you know, to playing esports.
Yeah, if you didn't know, O'Leary was a guy who attended the Madden tournament that was held in Jacksonville, Florida, the same one where a mass shooting took place. He himself was shot four times.
Once in the thumb.
Once in the thumb. I mean, but life-threatening injuries.
Yes.
Yeah.
But also shot once in the thumb. They had to do emergency surgery also on his thumb to keep it attached to his hand.
Yikes!
And he made a comeback and is still playing in the league to this day in the 2K league. So again, someone like that absolutely
deserves
accolades, absolutely deserves to be praised and hailed, and I'm very happy that he was able to win that ESPY.
So, but criticism is not with who won.
No, it was the road to get there.
However, here is my issue. In the category, the nominee he had going up against him.
The other finalist.
The other nominee.
Well, because let's talk a little bit about how this process works, because you've got to, it's first sent out for general voting.
It's fan voting.
Right.
This category was sent out general for fan voting.
Right. And then the second round of voting is industry professionals, right?
That's in a normal ESPY. If I'm not mistaken,
that's not what happened here.
Is strictly fan voting.
Oh.
It's probably because they don't have anyone in the building that knows enough about esports.
That is a strong possibility.
Yikes.
Now, it's not like there's not.
Because I remember seeing all of them, all the different like categories and whatnot, or all the different choices on Twitter. In fact, I have the final one pulled up.
Yeah. I voted on this, you know, through the different rounds I was voting, you know, because hey, fan voting or whatever. Here is who ended up the finalist was Ninja.
Of course.
And Marshmello winning the Fortnite Pro-Am.
The Pro-Am?
Now, Let me explain something here. Yeah.
That was out at E3, right?
Let me I don't care where it was.
Well, no, I'm just saying that was the event out at E3. Xavier Woods was there.
It was the year previous.
Oh, it was the year what?
Yeah.
Cuz you got to go a calendar year.
It's the calendar. It's
I guess you couldn't
do it now.
I suppose.
Yeah. Now, here's my problem with this. Fan voting on the surface is okay, but it only needs to be a portion of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
because the vast majority of people who are voting on this are going to vote for one who their favorite is.
Popularity contest.
It's just a popularity contest. Now, don't get me wrong. Award shows on the surface, you know, when you break them down, are just a popularity contest anyway. But you would expect journalists, coaches, players to have some sort of nuance.
Yeah.
I understand why old Larry is there. Why he is a finalist.
Sure.
This is a man who was shot multiple times, once in his hand, and made it back to still play professionally in esports. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Ninja had no business being there.
He won a tournament.
If we're okay, but that's compared to Shanghai.
Becoming the first woman in the 2K league.
Exactly. Team Liquid beating
Invictus
at MSI.
Is Ninja even an esports pro anymore? He's a pro streamer. There's no argument there.
No.
But he failed to qualify for the World Cup. I would think that in the, you know, when it comes to classifying somebody's technical profession, he does not meet the minimum bar required an esports athlete. He's not sponsored by a team. He's not part of an org. And he washed out of the World Cup.
I would be inclined,
and this is the dude that's writing the Get Good book.
I would be inclined to agree with you. However, if it's a pro-am, that's a competition, so you can count that, I guess. But my issue lies in the fact that that is even a category. That's even a pick in the entire ecosystem, to be honest.
Yeah.
And to leave it completely up to a fan vote, you knew what the outcome was going to be. To add a layer even on top of that is that Ninja was ahead in the polling, and it wasn't until Ninja said, "Oh, I just realized who I was up against. I don't want to beat him. Go vote for him."
Yeah.
Yeah, he had deleted his initial tweet that was like, "Hey guys, go vote for me," and then retweeted endorsing Larry.
To be honest, that's the right thing.
Sure. Like, yes, it's the right thing. I'm not blaming Ninja himself for that.
Yeah.
But how can you call this a legitimate award?
Right, when effectively what it has come down to is who has the biggest Twitter following.
It was manipulated.
Wait a minute. How can you call this a legitimate award when they gave it out on the carpet and not even as a part of the actual award ceremony?
No, plenty, because that I'm not going to be mad, because plenty of awards, even at the Oscars, get given away before the official show, because there's a lot of awards, and they get given away before the actual show proper starts.
Yeah, but ones anyone cares about get given out during the show,
right? But and if you want this to be a good show of faith to the esports community,
you put it on the stage.
The first one that you do is out on the carpet.
You put it on the stage.
Yeah,
you put it on the stage.
It was the very, I think it was the very first award given out.
But you put it on the stage.
Yeah.
If you're going to show that you're serious about supporting esports, you put it on the stage.
Especially a dude. If you know you're giving it to O'Leary, and let's be honest, they knew the results. You know, like right, like this could have been, a really good moment and a healing moment. This is a guy who lived through a mass shooting, and you're just going to stick him on the red carpet, like.
But that goes back to the whole thing where we're talking about you're not having people with nuance in these rooms making the decisions about how to do something with esports.
Sure,
I would have rathered that not even be a part of the show, to be honest with you, because when you have something like somebody as popular as Ninja. At that point, it wouldn't have mattered who he was going up against. If he said, "You know what? I don't want to win. Give it to them. They'd have won."
Yeah.
So, to me, that's why fan voting should have been taken out of that equation from the get-go. And if that's what they're going to do with esports awards and esports voting, don't have it.
Yeah.
Right. Don't have it. Because I don't want that. I want this to be given the same respect that they give to any other award or any other award show.
I mean, I think it's frustrating that it played by its own set of rules, right? Like that it somehow was different than the other awards. I don't know if ESPN doesn't feel like they're qualified or if they have, you know, they have Jacob Wolf on staff. Really? You couldn't have called Jacob to get over there and like help you judge on this? Like, come on,
ESPN could have sent out a mass email to Kotaku Kotaku, Polygon, .esports, Dexerto,
Checkpoint XP.
Checkpoint XP. There's a litany of outlets and publications that they could have sent the email to and say, hey, we want to bring you guys in for voting on our esports thing, right, in addition to ESPN's own staff. Yeah. And they could have voted on this. Not it would have been no issue. But instead, what we got was a farce of an award that ended up eventually going to somebody who deserved it.
Yeah, but not without
the road up to it.
But not without considerable mention by the hosts themselves. Well, Ninja had to direct his fans to make sure that they voted to him. Like, they said that as a part of giving the award out. Oh. Aren't you undercutting
the validity of that award at that point?
Right?
I mean, yes. Listen, man, like, when it's an all-star game, I never have a problem with fan voting. I know it never works out that well, but like, if you're picking people to go to your all-star game, sure, let the fans vote on who they want to see in the all-star game.
I got an issue with that too.
With more time, we could get into that. But like, when it comes to the Hall of Fame, all of a sudden it's like, you know what? Maybe we don't let the fans vote for who goes into the Hall of Fame. Maybe we're going to let the journalists. Maybe we're going to let, you know, coaches, former players, like, people.
So if the argument is to create context of them picking somebody over the length of somebody's career, what's the difference between the length of a year where somebody should be getting an award that they deserve? It's no different. That's why fan voting is asinine, because most fans are just going to pick their favorite and they're not going to be objective, period.
Well, but I mean, if that's the point of the contest, you know, that's why you have viewer's choice and stuff like that. If you want to know, if you want to run a popularity contest and you want the results of a popularity contest, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
But if you want something that's a bit more objective and fair, which I think that's what the ESPYs would want, then maybe consider getting some people in there who actually know what they're talking about. Obviously, we're fired up about this, but we want to hear from you. Do you think that the ESPYs kind of screwed the pooch on this one? Connect with us on social media. That's Checkpoint XP on Facebook and Twitter, and Checkpoint_XP on Instagram. Still ahead on Checkpoint XP Daily, we'll sit down with Noah Smith. He is a contributing writer for The Washington Post, and he's penned an article called What Esports Contracts Should Look Like. That conversation will wrap up today's Checkpoint XP Daily. But ahead next, we'll sit down with FGC commentator Script. Stick around, that's at next on Checkpoint XP Daily.
This is Checkpoint XP, esports and gaming radio.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is Checkpoint XP, esports and gaming radio. CheckpointXP.com.
Welcome back to Checkpoint XP Daily, your home for esports and gaming. My name is Nate Bender, so glad to have you along. I want to thank everyone listening on the sports beat of East Texas, 104.3 in Carthage, 103.9 in Marshall, and 100.7 in Henderson, as well as 1250 and 94.5 ESPN San Antonio. Checkpoint XP Daily is now a part of the BPod Network at bpodstudios.com. For more great listening options like Inside the Ropes, a weekly look inside wrestling and WWE, and Talkin' Rock with Meltdown, an interview and music news podcast, then go to bpodstudios.com, the place to be for podcast discovery. Joining us now is FGC commentator Script. Script, welcome into Checkpoint XP.
What's popping, guys?
What's going on, man?
Super glad to have you here. So I want to know, how did you get into casting for the FGC?
Oh, okay. So I was an athletic kid. I was athletic as a kid, played a lot of sports. And once I got into college, I kind of lost my way in doing that because I didn't have, you know, I wasn't that good. But I found a competitive outlet through fighting games, and I loved that.
That's definitely a good outlet.
Yes.
And I was a strict player for about 2 years, and then I slowly, through like the local scene, growing up through that, I started to climb the ranks. Now I'm seeing a lot of cool tournaments.
So what were your games?
Ooh, big Smash Bros. Guy, man.
Melee? Would you main?
All of them, man. I play Fox in all of them.
Okay.
I'm a loyalist. Let's be real. But I started with Smash 4. Then I went back to Melee, played that for a while. Now Ultimate came out. Like, you can't ignore that.
So you cannot play Ultimate.
I've been running that pretty much every single day.
It's not Brawl, you know?
Right.
Brawl is, I think, universally everyone has agreed. We can ignore that one.
Yeah. Mm. And I got to ask about that because for, it seems like, about 15 years and 3 Smash Brothers games, they come out, people would go, yep, this is the one that'll supplant Melee. It would come out, and then it would not supplant Melee. Mm-hmm. Ultimate has found a space, has carved out a space, and it is really doing well for itself. What is your stance on Ultimate?
I think Ultimate is exactly the boost we needed, because at the end of Smash 4, it was feeling a bit drab, a little bit repetitive with the same characters getting the top 8s.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
But now you see so much character diversity now, too. Like, I think it's over in like 30 or 40 characters make top 8 alone in Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. So I just think seeing that variety and people can express themselves in more diverse and better ways, it's really cool to see.
Well, and the crowd responds to it as well, right? Out at Frostbite, when we were at Frostbite.
Which you casted, by the way.
I did cast at Frostbite. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So the Belmont pick that was in there towards the was that in top 8 or top 4?
That was top 8.
That was top 8?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was ridiculous, the pop that got. And that match was amazing.
He down aired the Pikmin. We're still talking about it. He did a move where you need to collide with something, and you collided off.
Got back onto the stage. Oh my god! We sat back, and it was because Joe has a sibling who was very heavy into Smash at the time.
Yeah,
and
competed in that
tournament, and we all were in the back area, and we saw that, and for a split second, we went, wait a minute.
It's really like one of those Jordan moments. Like, you're just like, you have to be there to see it, and you're going to be talking about it forever. It's crazy.
Okay, yeah. All right. Speaking of moments, obviously the FGC is just littered with them all throughout the FGC history. I have to know, do you have a favorite call of your own that you've ever done?
I do, and it's a pretty recent one as well.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. I was at Smash and Splash 5, which is the top 3 biggest tournaments in the Midwest, had about 1,600 entrants, maybe up to 2,000 this year's iteration. And it was top 32, and it was Tweak, the one seed. Are you familiar? TSM sponsored
Tweak. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Playing Young Link and Wario versus, I believe, the 36th seed, playing Politena, the great Gonzalez, a New Jersey player. And he just came out swinging. Game 1, bopped. Tweak got knocked down. Down 1-0. Comes out second game, bop. Down 2-0. Tweak down 2-0. Then he gets on the Wario. Let me tell you, Politena Wario is horrible. It's a horrible matchup. He makes it work, pulls out the third game just to bring it back. And when I say the fire lit in the great Gonzalez, and he took stocks with such ruthless efficiency, and there's a specific moment in there. I could pull up the clip in a little bit, and we do a little bit more casual talk, but man, I highly encourage everyone to go check that out.
Awesome. You know, as the FGC guy in room, you know what I'm saying? I've gotten to get these guys a little bit more into it, but the Smash community right now, it's a lot going on, and we cannot talk about this. It's a lot going on in the Smash community. Not all of it that great. What is your stance right now with the Smash community? I mean, people have been going after female competitors. We got some scandals going on with people dating underage folks. You know, the Smash community is one of the most visible and vocal out there in the FGC. You know, from your stance, especially in the Midwest, you know, what does the Smash community need to do to sort of like rein it in and get everybody on target?
That is a very good question. I'll give you that. But I think that we are in a point of misunderstanding with a lot of people. Everyone is feeling like kind of the new game jitters. They want to get out there. They want to do their best. And a lot of people are like really, really committed to Smash Brothers. Even though, like, you guys know it's a very, very visible game, but it's a game that doesn't see a lot of money support.
That's true.
Or mainstream support. So it's a lot of people dedicating their lives with pretty much no backing to do this stuff. So it just comes down to you. It's such a commitment, you just lose yourself. So I think people need to get their wits about them and just kind of get priorities straight, and then understand Smash for what it is from that point.
So speaking of the Midwest, by the way, you're listening to Checkpoint XP, your home for esports and gaming. We're hanging out with Script. He's a caster for the FGC. So speaking of the Midwest, it's been a chronically underserved area for esports. We get a lot of FGC going on. We've got, of course, the summer split finals that are coming for League of Legends. But in general, there's not a ton that goes on that's super visible visible nationally in esports out of the Midwest. Why do you think that is?
It's such a big place, pretty much, and you have like kind of a similar talent pool. You see a lot more concentration in like esports activity when it comes to like a lot of other places. So you'll see like Florida will have like Miami, and then you'll have Houston that's running a lot of stuff in Texas, and you have Southern California running a lot of stuff as well.
Sure.
But with the Midwest, the talent pool is so widespread, it's kind of hard to pick your place you want to go, because you can go to Chicago, but then you're still six, like 4 hours away from Wisconsin, 4 hours away from Michigan, and then Ohio is about six. So
there hasn't been one sort of like centralized place like in the Midwest established. So what do you see as in terms of like cities that could possibly be in contention for a role like that?
I think Detroit's obvious as well.
We would agree. You get no argument.
No argument.
None.
I mean, I think the thing is that Chicago has the population and sort of the cultural cachet, but it's not equidistant from a lot of places. Whether it's Detroit, you got, you know, Chicago 4 hours away, Cleveland 3 hours away.
You can even pull in from north of the border.
I mean, 3.5 hours away from Toronto.
Does the fact that Michigan is a peninsula factor in here at all? Because that's you know, like I in my previous jobs have dealt a lot with bands, and that's what you hear a lot when they're bringing up touring schedules and stuff. We skip Detroit because you got to go, you know, into the peninsula
and then come back out.
Right. And there's not really great stops between there and, you know, say Chicago. So do you think that factors in at all? Because you do have to kind of travel into the state a little bit.
That makes sense. I can understand that, though. But I feel like the way that you have to travel as a band with just one single like trip with people, and instead you have a drove of people coming to an event or coming to a place.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of times you're talking about like a you know, 5-6 people piled into a van, and gas is a major consideration.
Right.
So yeah, it's a little bit different, because a lot of times when people are traveling for esports events, they're not driving. Mm-hmm. You know, they're taking planes and stuff. So it can be a little bit more direct. Yeah, that's true.
Like the LCS Summer Finals, that is the ticket in this city. That's the hottest ticket in Detroit right now.
Do you guys have yours?
We'll talk about it later.
Probably have to wait until we're off air.
Press badge, I would hope.
Fingers crossed.
Well, I got mine. Good news.
That's good news. Well, let's go humble brag. Why don't you? Sure.
Well, we may have to reach out to.
So you want to come back on the podcast?
Exactly.
Anytime.
So what do you think? What do you think can be done to improve the visibility of the Midwest outside of? Because there's a lot of talent that comes out of the Midwest. You know, Ninja is from, you know, downriver. You know, some of the most visible talent in streaming and esports is coming out of the Midwest.
Myth is from Dearborn.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you think could be done to improve the visibility of esports in the Midwest?
I think something that can improve the visibility across the Midwest would also improve visibility across the world. I think getting better internet, like 5G, we need something like that. We need to get, you know,
that's a great point.
South Korea has phenomenal connection, and that's why they're producing some of the best online esports and going into the professional scene.
That's an interesting point. I never really thought about that.
You know, and that's a good point too, because you know, you have the downtown core of Detroit, which is pretty much saturated with fiber internet, but it's not available anywhere outside of that like 3.5 square mile radius anywhere else in the city.
I know. I've tried to get it so many times.
Like Petoskey's got like 60 ping, bro. Like, what you gonna do?
that's another thing. And so, you know, when we talk about states like Michigan that, you know, have very sort of
pockets of people.
I mean, all states have pockets of people, but we're not like Montana where the whole thing is rural. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I think that coverage for the internet is very important, especially as we move into the next gen. But I want to go back to Smash right quick and really just talk about where you see it going, because you're talking about the investment that's been put into Smash. But this is the first game with Smash Ultimate that Nintendo has put any sort of money into, any sort of support into. You know, what more can Nintendo do in order to make Smash Ultimate a more healthy environment?
I think they're taking like a hands-off approach to it. They want to let you know that it's there, but they don't want to be the one to directly point you to that thing, because it's like
The Nintendo way.
Right. Yeah, it's a roundabout way, but it also lets you build on your own and lets you make the scene what you'd like it. I really like the model they have now with introducing like pro players and pro casters through their Nintendo endorsed events, Nintendo-sponsored events, like you saw at E3 and things like that. So letting them know that there's that outlet there to follow, and if you want, if you enjoy what you're seeing with these players, you by all means have the opportunity to go research on your own and find out from there. So I think it's a really good place to be if, as Nintendo, even though it's not hands-on like everyone would like. I feel like there'd be a lot of things about the community that would be changed if Nintendo had a hand directly into it that people wouldn't too much enjoy.
Jack Script Ross, a caster for the FGC, has been our guest here today on Checkpoint XP. Script, man, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been a good time.
Thanks again to Script for his time. For full interviews, make sure you visit our website over at CheckpointXP.com. Coming up next on Checkpoint XP, we'll sit down with Washington Post contributor Noah Smith to talk about what esports contracts should look like. Stick around that discussion. We'll wrap up today's Checkpoint XP Daily.
This is Checkpoint XP. Check out the latest esports and gaming news and opinions at CheckpointXP.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is Checkpoint XP, esports and gaming radio. CheckpointXP.com.
Welcome back to Checkpoint XP Daily, your home for esports and gaming. My name's Nate Bender. So glad to have you along. Joining us now is friend of the show, Noah Smith. He's a contributor to the Washington Post and has just written an article called What Esports Contracts Should Look Like. Noah, welcome into Checkpoint.
No, it's great to be back, and thanks for having me on. And I would say I hope you recovered from July 4th, but really I'm going to say I hope you recovered from E3, because that is probably one that's taking a little bit longer to recover.
Well, and I think at this point, too, Noah, you are officially friend of the show.
That's right.
Thank you for giving us some of your time, as always.
That's right. So Noah wrote a fantastic article for the Washington Post, What Should Esports Contracts Look Like? And you talked to Ryan Morrison, a.k.a. the video game lawyer, as he's known on Twitter, founding partner for Morrison Rothman LLP, as well as Bryce Blum, the founding partner of ESG Law, which is a dedicated esports law firm where he represents esports teams, talent, and institutions. And you guys kind of collectively had a conversation about what esports contracts should look like. And this was kind of brought into the forefront by the Tfue story and the back and forth that he's had with FaZe Clan. And I thought this was a first of all, if you have not read the article, you should absolutely go check it out. It's a fascinating discussion and knocked a lot of really interesting points loose. But I think a starting point that seems as natural as any as is, Noah, what was the big takeaway that you walked away from at the other side of this conversation?
Well, I think after an intro like that, I'm not sure how much I should say, because I don't want to downgrade the article itself. But I think the major takeaway was that every player needs an independent lawyer. And I think it's probably not surprising given the fact that there were two lawyers talking here. But a lot of the problems the Tfue experience would have been avoided by that, but not all of them. There were some very fundamental differences that emerged from this specific conversation, but that have been sort of exemplified by the whole lawsuit that Tfue filed. But what I would say is that, and maybe one way of sort of assessing these two different worlds that these two lawyers were talking about, is that Bryce is arguing from a place of you'd say like free markets and negotiations, basically that this is all okay because both teams and players are freely entering into a business negotiation and they're getting what each side is getting what they negotiate for. That's sort of where he's coming from. But then Ryan saying from the player standpoint that, well, but the dice are heavily stacked, so to speak, on the side of the organizations, and this isn't really a fair negotiation. And then Bryce is saying, but that is exactly why these players want to be on these, be with these organizations, because they have this power, this ability to provide benefits. And so then if you want to take it from there to the specifics, what Bryce is saying is that what players are saying is that basically, and the reason why, for instance, Sifu's situation came out like it did is that, or at least the argument is that they want guaranteed upfront money as opposed to sharing some risk and then taking part of any back-end funds that come in through sponsorships or them getting bigger profiles. But Ryan looked at that same situation and said, well, but that's really more like investing in penny stocks, is I think how he put it,
sure,
where
yeah.
these organizations are just able to throw out all this money and then hope it works out, and if it doesn't, we'll throw the player away, so to speak, and then if not, we get rich off of them. And then to bring some numbers into it for Tfue, for instance. So Tfue started off, I looked into it, he had 36,000 views in January 2018 on YouTube. In April, when he signed with them, he had 2 million. But then by January 2019, he had 116 million. So that is sort of the, you know, sort of exemplifies what we're talking about here and then who should benefit and why. And I think ultimately it just reflects the state of esports where these basic goalposts are, for a mixed metaphor, are still very much being established in terms of what an esports organization really is.
Well, there was considerable conversation and debate given to what is considered industry standard. And I think my takeaway is even if somebody is arguing that something is industry standard, the industry is in such, you know, is in still such an infantile state, like early on in its development, that I don't think you can argue that anything is necessarily industry standard, even if it's a widely adopted policy. So, I'm kind of curious if there was anything that you walked away from this exchange with, regarding what would be considered industry standard.
Yeah, and I have to agree with that. I mean, there's a funny story. I remember I did an interview with Rick Fox and over at Echo Fox, and they have a really funny situation like that with him and his executives, and they were trying to do a trade with a player, and that's what they got in the trade. That this other team wanted a transfer fee, like you'd see in like the European soccer league.
Sure.
And then Echo Fox had balked at that, and then the response was, well, this is industry standard, and they use an expletive, but you know, the response was sort of like, What do you mean industry standard? This industry, like, this has been around for like a year,
sure,
like, or 2 years, in at that scale. So, as far as industry standard, the answer is, in some cases yes, in some cases no. I mean, I'd have to answer no if I had to come down on one side or the other. I mean, there are certainly, depending on the league, right? So, like an Overwatch League contract compared to a League of Legends contract, like for players playing in those specific leagues, there are definitely standards of, you know, minimum salaries and benefits and so on and so, days off, guaranteed vacation, you know, things like that. When it
right.
comes to organizations that are, you know, negotiating with players that are not in one of those two leagues specifically, it is a little bit of the Wild West, and it's opaque. And so that was another big thing that emerged from this, and also that emerged in the debate between those two lawyers, is transparency and trying to get more transparency for even basic things like salaries that we see in traditional sports. And so it becomes very difficult to understand really the reality of a lot of clauses and a lot of terms of these contracts. But I mean, I would say, I mean, to answer the question in terms of like what is expected, usually you're going to have some required amount of time available for sponsors, sometime, you know, that's required for streaming, sometime that's required for other team activities. And then, you know, salary, and then obviously the big splits are on the share of sponsorships and other forms of revenue that the player is generating.
Right, right. And you spoke quickly about transparency, and for me, you know, that's one thing that esports has not quite done that traditional sports seems to be, to a certain extent, very, very adept at. I mean, we hear contract numbers, we hear signing bonuses, we get those numbers at the onset, sometimes
sure.
even in negotiation before any, you know, ink has been put to paper. Why do you think that, you know, esports hasn't necessarily, you know, moved in that direction? Because even as we see it now, we know that the contracts in Overwatch League are guaranteed, but we very rarely get the numbers in those contracts.
Well,
so
I think the reason for that is because of the players that we're seeing. Like, we haven't gotten to a point where, oh my God, there's a major free agent, who's he going to end up signing with? The reason you see those contract numbers come out when you're looking at something like, you know, baseball. Well, how come we didn't get that star pitcher? How come Justin Verlander didn't sign with us? Well, the other team offered him $100 million more.
Right.
Oh, that's why.
Well, and I do think that, you know, one of the other things that I kind of found myself remarking is that, you know, a big value here is understanding your own value within the space. And that's really where kind of there's a lot of disagreements because, you know, Tfue, when he signed up for FaZe Clan, could you argue that it was the resources that FaZe gave him that allowed his channel to see so much growth? I think, you know, the truth is kind of somewhere in the middle that, yeah, it was Tfue as a personality, but it was also FaZe Clan and the you know, the resources that they gave him access to that were able to grow his channel like that.
But that argument could be made for almost any athlete on earth outside of, you know, natural gifts, if you will. Very few people are, you know, LeBron James, just freaks of nature, right? But there are plenty of athletes that have benefited from playing for certain coaches, going to certain schools, playing in certain systems. I don't think esports should be any different. If somebody shows a specific talent for a specific game and the situations and the stars align, what makes the difference for somebody being able to have a super high valuation and demand a $1 million contract in esports? I know that's not necessarily the norm right now, but I just feel like if esports is going to continue to grow and move in that direction, that's part of what makes this whole thing move, is the contract numbers, speculation, and all that stuff. I'm just curious as to why that hasn't happened yet.
So I think that there's, I mean, all the things you just said, I think the other big element to mention is unions.
Yes.
I mean, the reality is that the reason why we're not hearing these numbers is because they don't have to. And disclosing the terms of these contracts, I would argue, benefits the players, obviously, because then they can say, well, Ninja got this, I have more views than Ninja, I want more money than Ninja. And that's what we see, for instance, with like Manny Machado and Bryce Harper, or what we're seeing now in the NBA, where it's like that, where you're establishing a market value, and then, you know, being able to leverage that for your own, you know, for a player's own purposes. I think the other big problem here is that, Norris, you had mentioned that, I mean, it's a lot of speculation going on here. So one of the articles I wrote recently for the Post is about this, is about these teams being valued at hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in the VC venture capitalist way of valuing these things, which is like, well, there's a lot of attention, and so we hope to be able to convert that to value at some point down the road. And so
theoretical value.
You theoretical, right, exactly. Hope.
Yeah.
You're investing based on hope. You know, as far as getting players to that point where, you know, they are able to demand these things, there does have to be the ability for them to back it up somehow, or for the teams to be able to justify this to their investors, like, hey, we're going to put $5 million towards this player, and then, but we're going to see the return on that from, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then, of course, the problem right now for esports organizations is that a lot of the, and this also made its way into the debate, is that the traditional sports revenues aren't necessarily as robust. They're not as robust as they are for traditional sports teams as compared to esports teams, but there are ones available. I mean, Twitch had $90 million for the Overwatch League. We know, we see it all the time. You know, it's on TNT and TBS, and it's certainly a growing thing in terms of traditional linear TV for esports. I think that the answer to this comes back to, if I had to make an argument, I would say it comes to the lack of unions and just to the volatility of the industry.
You're listening to Checkpoint XP Esports and Gaming Radio. We're sitting down with Noah Smith, contributing writer for the Washington Post, about the article that he wrote called What Should Esports Contracts Look Like? If you haven't checked it out, you should check it out. It's a really fascinating read. You know, one of the things that I think is, you know, really apparent, and I'm really glad that you brought up, unions and representation, is that, you know, I think that there is a misconception about the way that revenues are being driven. I think that more, you know, from someone who is looking to be an esports athlete, right, like and present within these leagues, I think that there might be a misconception of where the money is actually coming from. And one of the things, Noah, that you bring up in your piece is that most of the revenue is being driven off of sponsorship, not from ticket sales and other more traditional models of revenue.
That's right. Booties in the seats,
right,
as we call it.
Exactly. There are very few leagues that can actually leverage that kind of appeal. So, you know, I really did appreciate, you know, that piece of information. But do you think that there's, you know, more education on the player side on how the business actually works would be beneficial here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, and at least short of that, if they're not going to do that, then again, hire a lawyer. I mean, I'm hearing stories about teams going, and I don't know how much this is still taking place. It could be a little bit outdated for like a year or two, but where players are being dissuaded from hiring a lawyer, saying, hey, that's not like a friendly thing to do. It's not nice. We're just talking here and, you know, you're going to get a lawyer, you know? And so, and I think probably we're past that point. But yeah, I think that players should really understand, like you were saying before, to understand their value, number one, but then understand that they are now participating in a billion-dollar industry. You know, it's no longer kids. I mean, it is people still, you know, playing games for fun at home and this and that, and that's great. But there's a lot of money changing hands at this point, and
absolutely,
they're very much a part of it, and they absolutely need to educate themselves or hire somebody who is educated in it.
And another frightening example from your piece are, you know, people who have brought lawyers into bargaining situations and then suddenly the deal's taken off the table. Like, that to me is a huge red flag. You know, and I don't know, if I was going to advise somebody in that situation, maybe it's better to miss out on that opportunity than to be put into a completely predatory situation.
Well, again, and that's the part that remains confusing to me, because we talk about we often talk about the ages of some of these players coming into these leagues,
yeah,
right? We're talking about 18 and 19 year olds, in some cases kids who are pretty much signed in everything but name and just can't participate in the league officially yet. But at the same time, that paradigm already exists in professional sports, where kids have come straight out of high school, or kids have done the one and done in the NBA's case. You're going in as a 19 year old. That's not very different. So I don't understand why, you know, the whole lawyer, agent, team, union sort of, you know, trifecta or
dynamic
quadrangle, yeah, whatever you want to call it, is not there yet in esports. And again, it is a nascent industry,
sure,
and it's not quite there yet. But I feel like, and Noah, maybe you could speak a little more to this, I feel like for esports to continue to grow, those things must be in place, or this whole thing is doomed to crash in on itself.
There's no question. One way or the other, it'll crash in, either from a regulatory standpoint or just from a pure business standpoint. And so I think that a lot of what's prevented this in the past is parents, maybe, or other people who are responsible for these kids, you know, these young players, didn't understand the value of any of this. I mean, if you're talking about, all right, they're going to throw my kid $1,000 a month, couple $1,000 a month, which is not nothing, to be clear, but it's also not millions. You're thinking, all right, it's good faith, do it for a year, then go to college, no big deal. But now that there's this understanding that, hey, it's not that, it's potentially millions,
yeah,
I think that shifts the paradigm quite a bit. And then as far as the industry being able to grow in a healthy, sustainable way, I think lawsuits like this are going to have a major impact, because you're going to have regulation, you're going to have, adjudicated opinions basically saying, all right, these esports organizations are talent agencies, they have certain responsibilities they're in, or saying that they're not talent agencies and that players are not going to feel beholden to sign for some of these 80%, 20% deals, which are insane. I mean, you think about Hollywood talent agencies take 10%. This was, you know, FaZe was saying they're taking 80%. It's crazy, but it's hard. I mean, like was brought up, I mean, when you're 19 years old, 20 years old, someone's throwing you, you know, thousands of dollars, you know, and you're not sure if you're going to get another one. This is the first one you've ever gotten. You're going to take it. I mean, I remember, yeah, the first amount I was paid for a published article, and it's like, looking back on it, I was like, man, I can't believe I did that. But at the time, it was like, I can't believe I'm getting paid at all to do something that I actually want to do. And it's kind of fun and cool, and people are going to see it and this. And that's ultimately very dangerous for players when the upside is millions, as opposed to journalism, where it's
Right, and that's the thing.
Considerably.
Tell us about it.
We live in this kind of era where that frame of mind is still so pervasive of, I can make money playing video games, as much as we hate hearing that. And yes, you can, but you also have to be willing to look at what your value is and say, yeah, but how much should you make playing video games? And is it worth turning down the first offer to maybe take the second offer that's a little bit more fair to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there are, at the end of the day, you know, when all is said and done, and when we look back at kind of this moment in 10 years, you know, there are going to be people who will be like, I dedicated my entire life to it and I still couldn't hack it. And, you know, yeah, Should you feel bad for those folks? Absolutely. But at the same time, though, you know, I think the worst case scenario is you get put into a situation where you're actively preyed upon by an organization that will, you know, just take advantage of the fact that you're an enthusiast about this. Noah Smith has been our guest here on Checkpoint XP. Again, a contributing writer for the Washington Post. Please go check out his article, What Should Esports Contracts Look Like? And connect with us on social media. That's Checkpoint XP on Facebook and Twitter, and Checkpoint_XP on Instagram. And let us know what you think esports contracts should look like. Noah, thanks so much for joining us here on Checkpoint XP.
Thank you. Always a blast. Have fun.
Thanks again to Noah for his time. For full interviews, make sure you visit our website over at CheckpointXP.com. Thanks for joining us for Checkpoint XP Daily, the first internationally syndicated show on esports and gaming for radio. Visit our website, CheckpointXP.com, for insight on esports and gaming, as well as a full archive of episodes, podcasts, and interviews. Join us Monday through Friday live at 5 p.m. Eastern at twitch.tv/CheckpointXP. Our theme is provided by the band Weird At Last. Find more at weirdatlast.com. Checkpoint XP Daily is a production of Beasley Esports XP. Lead segment producing by Joe Sloan. Producing and booking help from Christine Solis. And, of course, my co-hosts who pull double duty as producers for Checkpoint XP Daily. Robbie Landis, Norris Howard, and Joe Sloan. Money's a bender! Keep listening.
You've been listening to Checkpoint XP, a complete look at all things esports and gaming. Check out the latest esports and gaming news and opinions at CheckpointXP.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.